Well, it's January 22nd. Glad to be here. Let's get right to it because, as always, a lot to do. And quickly, I listened to the tape class from 2 weeks ago, and I can't believe I misspoke and talking about the percentage of the status quo. I said 10 or 15%. No way. Even got the exact numbers. They're about, you see them in Hartman's book, Patriots Without a Homeland. In 1930, neo-Orthodox are 65%, Orthodox and status quo. Orthodox are 30%, status quo is 4%. So you're talking, a small percentage for status quo. So let me put this down here. Ah, this is great. I got the wrong for Professor Steiner. I didn't exactly get the name of the book correct about the Shin. The title of the book is, I said, The Case for the Fricative Shin. It's actually The Case for Fricative Laterals and Proto-Semitic. That'll keep you up at night, let me tell you. But it's quite interesting because as this is, if you read the Jewish link, this is Mitchell First. He's a lawyer, but he's written a number of interesting things. He collects them into books as pieces. And mostly summarizing, but often giving his own scholarship. In fact, he wrote original scholarship about the origin of Tani's Esther in the AGS Review, as well as other places. But in this article, he's just summarizing, and Steiner shows that originally, or argues, the shin, or the sin, the letter sin was pronounced SL. And that explains how you have, like, Kastim, we have Chaldees. In some places, it's pronounced in some documents, it's pronounced with an L. That's why it's Ur of the Chaldees. If you ever wonder how Kustine becomes Chaldees. So that's Professor Steiner. I don't know if our friend Nissen is with us. But Nissen, there you are. So here you go. Here's a good book on Yosef Fun, Pirudo Hishtadlut, Agudas Yisrael, Umedinat Israel. You got the whole story there of Aguda and Poale, as well as I have Binyamin Mintz's the biography, and what I said was correct. Well, we both were sort of correct, but Poale Agudas Yisrael was distancing itself from Aguda in the 40s, but they never officially broke with them. They ran together with them. It wasn't until the fourth Knesset in the 1950s. Also, they had big conflicts. But they remained together officially until this early 60s, and that's the fourth Knesset, as I recall. Then they broke, and that's when, as they say, all hell broke loose, and the stipler and attacks on them and everything. So, so that is correct. Thank you to Moshe for pointing out that I made a mistake in mentioning the name. I spoke about Yisrael Salanter's son, the one who died young, and I called him Yitzchak. Yitzchak is a son. I'll show you Yitzchak here. Here is Yitzchak. He's a Talmud Chacham. This picture of Yitzchak at the bottom here has been identified mistakenly as Rav Yisrael Salanter, and it's not. It's actually the son. But thank you very much for saying that. No, sorry. I spoke about the son who died young. Yes, I'm confused now. The engineer. Okay, his name was Lippman, Yom Tov Lippman. Lippman was a Shem Chol, not Yitzchak. Like I said, this one is Yitzchak. Now, incidentally, people I think will be interested that he had another son. Well, he had more than one other one, but he had the biggest Talmud Chacham of the sons of Yisrael Salanter. His name isn't even, his name is Hurwitz, Aryeh Leib Hurwitz. He was a Rav of a city. You know, they took last names for all sorts of reasons. And here's a Sefer, Chaye Aryeh. So why do I mention this? Because if you look at the introduction, there's a two-page introduction to the Sefer, and it's signed at the end of it by who? His widow. Ela Divrei Almonas Hagona Machaber Zal Sarah Elka Horovitz. Elka, that's another Shem Chol, I guess. Women sometimes only had a shem chol. Like my grandmother's name was Genendel. She didn't have a Hebrew name because she wasn't called to the Torah, so she just had a shem chol. So, and on the one hand, this is really interesting because you can count on one hand and have a few fingers left, as far as I know, cases where Yosef Zelger, Rabbi Yosef Zelger, his widow also has Hakdama, but she actually wrote it. She was a very like a maskilic type of woman, but I don't think she wrote it. I just think some rabbi wrote it. If you look at the Lashon in it, I have a feeling that there were women who could write it, but I have a feeling that some rabbi wrote the introduction and just signed her name. But notice she's not afraid to mention her name, Sarah Elkin Horovitz. It's not like and Yolkin Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the invitations to his children's wedding. He mentions his name and his wife's name. It's not like today in the Haredi world, Chas V'Shalom, to mention the wife's name. It's just they don't even mention the bride's name, but they mention Rabbi so-and-so and his wife invites you to the wedding. So you see that different there. Oh, now I want to get to what I was asked about. Quick, Yadid Nefesh, because one of you asked. If you recall, we were speaking about a few weeks ago, Yadid Nefesh. You know, if you look in the Siddur, it, at least in most Siddurim, it shows up, it's in Shal Shudas. But for whatever reason, it became a practice also to say it Erev Shabbos, either be some people before Mincha. I think Sfardim did it before Mincha. We do it before, but, I mean, we didn't do it. It became a practice before Kabbalah Shabbos. And among the modern Orthodox, it's pretty universal. In the Haredi world, not at all. In fact, someone had never even heard of this practice. So someone asks correctly, what's the story with the different Chadodis? If you look in the Koran Siddur, you see, is now Chadodi, Yadid Nefesh. You see, Yadid Nefesh, it's not the same words that we have. I'll show you the words in a minute. If you look in the Koran, not the Koran, the new RCA Siddur, you actually have both of them. On page in Kabbalah Shabbos, you have, before Kabbalah Shabbos, you have the Yadid Nefesh we all know and love, I guess. And then in the back on page 1342, you have the original, and they tell you that. In fact, we have the original Yadid Nefesh signed. I mean, in the signature. I have a copy of it here. I didn't put it on the screen, though, of Rav Eliezer HaZikri from the 16th century, a Mekubal. And there's two different versions, and there's different words in the versions. And now let me show you what I'm talking about here and explain to you something about this. Where is it? I brought it up. Here it is.
About
Okay.
Shifra.
Now, here it is. Okay. So, yes, so you know one of the differences. So, this is the version that is the actual version, which we don't sing. By the way, even though we sing both Sidurim, that is both versions, the common mistaken version and the true version. In this paragraph, it ends, although it's not chusa, it's chusha in the original, but it's the Alti Salam. It's all Alti Salam, but everyone sings it that, like, here's the version that, why does everyone sing Alti Salam? It's Alti Salam. And it has to be, it rhymes. Ta'am, olam, tisalam, olam. That's because, yes, in modern Hebrew you say tisalem. Actually, in all Hebrew you say or titalem, but in rabbinic biblical Hebrew it's a pausal. So at the end of the syllable it'll end not lame but lam. The problem is that in modern Hebrew you don't have a pausal. So everyone sings. So in shul you should try to sing it correctly tisalem. But also notice here it's the version we sing is ele chamdalibi. The original version is Ana Eli Machmad Libi. Rav Mazuz actually suggests that this was not just a mistake, but someone changed it because Machmad, that's how you say Muhammad. And they didn't want to use the word Muhammad there, so they changed it. But so, first of all, it's strange that now that we know the correct version, we don't recite it. We still say the false version of it. Maybe you say because the song, it'll be hard to get it in. I'm not sure. But incidentally, I'm holding the Rinas Yisrael Siddur here, which was a very influential Siddur. And the very Zionistic Seder, that has the original version, the correct version. Now, let me show you probably the major difference here. There's a few differences, but in this passage here, V'haysalach, instead of V'haysalach, not Simchas Olam like we have, Shifchas Olam. And that is that a servant, an eternal servant. And this is based on a pasuk in Devarim, Eved Olam. That's really the big difference. But also, look how it is ours. We end it, Yidin Nefesh Avrachaman Meshoch Avdecha El Ritzonecha. But look in the original. Yidin Nefesh Avrachaman Meshoch Avdach El Ritzonach. And that continues. As a pausal, the masculine, you can say avdach and ritzonach. Avdach is not really a pausal, it's in the middle, but you can still do it. And it's definitely it's masculine here. In fact, there's a problem in grammar in the false version we say, because where is it here? I didn't have So, oh, chamdalibi, eila chamdalibi. Lev in Hebrew is always masculine, so that's a mistake there. But what's going on? How do we know? If I don't have it on a screen now, but if I would show you, and I could show you the actual text of the author, there's no nekudot, so you can read the words, and we know what the words are, and how we don't do it correctly. But we don't know the vocalization. So how do I know? How does everyone know that it's Avdach, Ritzonach, in the next paragraph, next line, sorry, Yarutz Avdach, Kamalayal, Yishtach Avamul, Hadarach, instead of what we have it, Yarutz Avdacha, Kamalayal, Yishtach Avamul, Hadaracha? Well, that's because you have to know the rhyming here. And this isn't Yatei Tnuah, like we spoke about in the past. Yatei Tnuah, the Shvana doesn't count. This is just syllables. And each unit here is eight syllables. So let's count them. Yeh, did, ne, fesh, av, ha, rach, man. Notice it's not chataf patach. Then, but even if it's chataf patach, it still would be considered one. Me, shoch, it's one, two, av, dach, four, el, five, re, So, no. If it was Retzonecha, that would make it nine syllables. So it messes everything up. All the paragraphs have to be have to line up. They're not paragraphs. All the units have to line up with eight syllables. And if you make it masculine instead of Avasach, it's Avasecha. That adds. That messes up the whole thing here. Let's see. Ya roots of dach ke mo ya. Eight. Yish ta. I think here it's yish ta cha ve mu ha da rach. Actually, actually, the chata patach counts as a syllable. Wait, let me get it. I think. Yish ta cha ve mu Ha da rach. Yeah. So you can count it next to the inshul if you can go through it if you want, you see. So that's how we know, even though we don't have the nekudos, that it has to be that way, because like I said, it's done by syllables in units of eight syllables for each one. So there's Yadid
Maybe
Nefesh. I don't know how you change
L was
this.
added.
What?
Maybe L was added. Maybe they didn't want to count Yishtachaveh, the Chata Patach, as a syllable, so the way Yishtachaveh El Mol Hadarecha, the word El
No,
was
but
added.
you can't. But you look at all the other ones. This is repeated every single line. It becomes for us. It becomes they make it the kamatz instead of. So it has to be. I was wondering then because all the editions of it have it that the same way. And I was wondering how do they know? And then I said I tried to do the Tate Nuan. It didn't work. And then I found, of course, Rav Mazuz, as always, he points out that it's all by syllables. And that's how it has to be. Eight. By the way, Rav Mazuz points out something else in his Parsha sheet this week. I didn't know this, but many Sfardim don't. We have another Shalosh Shuddos tune, right? Askinu Sudasa. A few different tunes for that. And many Sfardim don't say it. Well, he re well, why not? I didn't, he records how when he was young, in Tunis, the Chabad rabbi who started there, his name was right, Pinson. There's a lot of Chabadnik in Pinson. I guess they're all one family. He told all the students they have to sing this song. It's important. And his father said, absolutely not. And why not? So Ramazu says, I'll read you the words. You know, it says there, Hanikavin and things like that. He says, well, you have nothing else to do just to fight with the Kalavin de Chatsifin, the Klipos. In other words, do we, any of us, have any clue what's going on here about the Klipos? This is all very Kabbalistic. I guess you can be Muhammad Sluss that no one knows what they're saying anyway. So what's the difference? It's just a good tune. But if you
It's all
actually know what it's
Kabbalistic.
saying, you know that you don't know what it's saying unless you're some expert in Kabbalah or you're learned. You don't like it, Moshe, what he said?
No, so it's all Kabbalah, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, let me tell you what I heard in the Beis Medrash of Gershom Scholem in the 1970s, Megabe Yedid Nefesh.
Yeah.
In 1972, in the 400th Yahrzeit of the Ari, Yehuda Libus, who was then a graduate student, now a famous professor, was given the job of creating a critical edition based on the original manuscript, which, by the way, is in the library in JTS in New York. So they could sing it at this great asifa that all the scholars were going to have in Tzfat to celebrate the 400th Yahrzeit of the Ari. What they discovered when they tried to do a critical edition, meaning the correct, accurate text, you can't sing it. It doesn't sing. And that's why I was told by, I think it was Tishbe, that the reason that the text we use to sing is because if you try to sing the original text, it just doesn't flow.
But you're assuming then, I'm assuming that the text became what it is, however, the Bacher Zetzer or whoever made it up, and then we
Somebody
created the
along the
song.
way,
I'm not,
when
I
they
don't think
try.
they made the song. They changed it dafka to make the song. That doesn't seem to make sense.
That was the
In fact, the
Masorah
song we sing, how old is that song, that version? I don't, the one we commonly sing. I
HaYetzim.
don't
That's
know.
an interesting question. I mean, the original was published in Sefer Haredim at the end of Sefer Haredim in Venice 1600.
Yeah, but it's not
And by
singing.
the way,
The Sefer
Askinu
Haredim.
Sudasa is one of the things that the Ari himself wrote. It's one of the
Wrote,
three.
right, correct. So
So it's all
Ramazuz is saying,
Kabbalah. So.
yeah, so Ramazuz is saying, we don't know Kabbalah. Why are we singing it? But Rabbi
Well,
Pinson
there are some
said,
people who think they do know Kabbalah.
okay,
You
that's why we
know,
all
there are
sing.
us
Oh, he's
Apikarsim
singing.
who,
Sorry, I don't. Okay, very good.
just
Thank you
want to
very much,
mention.
as always, Moshe.
Sure.
Moshe, for those who don't know, is an expert in many of these areas.
If I may.
In fact, for Torah in Motion, we should have you. You've studied and presented and written so many interesting and important things.
Oh, thank
We
you.
could all benefit. Okay, everyone, let's continue. I want to sort of finish up. I want to finish up today with the last, I guess, chapter of separatism in Eretz Yisrael, well, with Rav Kook. Maybe we'll finish, maybe we won't. I still have a couple of things I didn't get to, and I want to begin just by reading you. I mentioned Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, his letter to the Aguda, and the fact that the Aguda, the story hasn't been written honestly. And if there's an honest Aguda historian, he has to write it and explain that these people in Eretz Yisrael were not what we today consider mainstream Aguda. They were Kitzonim. And but you need to tell the story. Ritzvi Yehuda, here's his letter. It's published in Or HaMizrach, the first one, explaining this is in response to Agudas Yisrael that invited him to the first Asifa in Eretz Yisrael. And look, he was friends with many of these Rabbanim. He was close with some of them as well, but he had to say the truth. He said, "How can I participate with such an organization? Asher b'shmo ha'mefurash, with its in its name, nasata oto havoda hatzmeya." He's talking about how all those years it was under the mantle of Aguda, all the terrible things against Rav Kook that went on. Katser et yemei chayav shel Adoni Avi Mori Harav Zatzal. Lichbot orosh olam Yisrael v'araita. That is the things they did, the way they attacked him and abused him, shortened Rav Kook's life. And it goes on to say v'chunchu narim, that the young people were, you know, brought up, educated. No, are Agudas Yisrael. These were members of Agudas Yisrael. Now, granted, they never would have been allowed to be Agudas Yisrael in Poland or Lithuania, but they were part of the official Agudas Yisrael. Meumanim b'mischak liyotzoach nefesh et Adoni Avi Mori Harav Zatzal v'gam husband kol anashim urot b'machazat tumazay. What he's referring to here is when on Purim they put on this whole episode here where they announced it, they publicized it, that they're having an event, they're putting Rav Kook on trial, and they put him on trial and then they executed him. My memory is that they didn't burn him. It was that they had a fake shooting of him, and Mayor Porush was there. Later on, he had to say that he had nothing to do with it, and he was shocked and outraged. But this was, I mean, this outraged everyone. Everyone in Europe, when the Rabbonim in Europe heard about this, they couldn't, they were, so then why did Rav Sonnenfeld and the rest of them, how, you know, whether because they were afraid of these people, you know, these crazies, or, you know, they were all, it was incestuous, they were married into each other's families, but the fact remains that the most terrible, terrible things were done to be Mevaza Gdol Yisrael, the Mevaza, the Gera Rebbe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe when he came, so, and that is that day. This was officially part of the Agudas Yisrael. What can I tell you? Until Natura Karta broke away. Okay, I want to now. We basically did the American story of Auschwitz separatism. I want to read you something, though, from Ramosha Feinstein. Because I don't know how to, you know, how to respond to this other than it's saying it sounds right. Rav Moshe is asked, we saw Rav Moshe sign the letter against being in the joint rabbinic organization and the communal organizations. It's in Igros Moshe, Orachayim 2, number 61. And the question is, are you permitted, Imrshai Leyos member? That's how Ramosha writes it. I guess today we would say chaver or something. I love when Ramosha, the way he writes, even in a car, he doesn't know how to say car in Hebrew, so he writes car. Kuf, I think it's kuf alef resh. So can you be a member of the Mossad Shemachalim Shabbat? Can you be a member of an institution or organization that violates Shabbos? And he says that... in the city you are, there's a Mossad, now it could be a JCC or something like that, that violates Shabbos. He says, Pashur Uvaru, Sha'asar Liotshum, Ishri Shabbos Yisrael, Yisrael Lios, member of Mossad Kazeh, Aflin Yitzadaka. He says, you can't be a member of any organization, let's say Federation. Federation has events on Saturday, let's say, and they definitely do in places when there aren't many Orthodox Jews, or they still have non-kosher events. Ramosha holds, you can't be a member of this. And by the way, the Rav might have agreed with him on this. And I don't know if it makes me an extremist. It sort of makes sense. I don't think your local JCC to be a member to use the gym. I don't, Ramosha might have been banning that also. I think that's a little different. I don't see how that's different than being a member of any gym. But if you're part of the organization, it's like the Federation or JCC, you're on the board, you're involved with it, and it's a Mechal Shabbos, then Ramosha is saying you have a responsibility. I think the more liberal Orthodox would say, no, you don't. You're a member, but you're only a member for the good stuff, not for the bad stuff. But here's an example of where we see the philosophy of Auschwitz. And again, this might even be taken too far, because it could be that even rabbis, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Mordechai Horovitz, might have agreed in this situation. Because it's not like when you're in Frankfurt and you each have your own shul, but you're part of the community. Here, you're part of one organization, the same organization. So I'm not sure about that. But that's look, we don't have, as we said, real Auschwitz in America. But you all know that the more right wing wouldn't be involved in Federation. It's a bit of a problem because, you know, there's an old expression. If you're not there for the takeoff, you can't be there for the landing. So you can't really complain about yeshivas not getting money from Federation if you're not involved with Federation. We don't have official communities, but we pretty much are divided between the more liberal modern Orthodox that agrees with being in organizations like Federation, even if they do violate Shabbos, Rav Moshe, it seems to be saying that you can't be involved in an organization like that if they violate Shabbos. Now, it could be that Federation today, many of them don't violate Shabbos. That is, they have trips to Israel or Europe, and on Shabbos is a free day, and they make sure all the food's kosher. I can tell you absolutely, though, that in many places in America, that is not the case, and they still will have non-kosher events because they don't have any Orthodox. What do they need to? And that Rav Moshe would say, you can't. I know many rabbis of the more liberal side would say, you can still be a part, but Rav Moshe disagrees. But I want to complicate matters now because in the Masaras Moshe, which is the record of the years of Rav Mordechai Tendler, being the secretary to Rav Moshe, all the questions he asked, full of great stuff. You see something in there that complicates the story. This is volume 4, pages 440 to 441. First of all, just not really relevant exactly to what I'm going to say, but it's interesting because in page 440, he was asked, Rabbi Schwab had ruled, Rabbi Schwab, reflecting a real Auschwitz mentality, I guess you could say, had ruled that you can't, Toro College. He said that Toro College, it's forbidden. Toro College had rented from a conservative synagogue or a conservative school, it says, in Brooklyn, rooms. So the question is it usher to go into there? Because Rabbi Schwab said it's forbidden for Orthodox Jews. Actually, he said forbidden for anyone, but no one else is paying attention. So forbidden for Orthodox Jews to go to this branch of Torah College because it's inside a conservative school. I guess a Solomon Schechter. And Rav Moshe says, what's the problem? They're renting the space. It's at night. Nothing's going on then. And it's not even a synagogue. It's a school. So Rav Moshe doesn't think it's a problem. And Rav Tendler says, is there an issue there? Maybe we should be machmir. The students shouldn't daven. You know, they would daven. I guess Davin Myriv, maybe between classes at night, and Rav Moshe says it's not a problem. So here you see Rabbi Schwab, like a Frankfurt mentality, you can't even step foot into it. And then Rav Moshe was asked again, Rabbi Bloch from Lakewood asked him, can he go to Darshan to speak at the conservative synagogue? And then because, and Rav Moshe said, there's not an issue. Even Yirmiyahu, what Rav Moshe, he knew his Tanakh. He brings a proof. Look at this. Rav Moshe brings a proof from Jeremiah, the book of Jeremiah. This is chapter 19, verse 14. It says Jeremiah came from Tophet, where the Lord had sent him to prophesy. Tophet is where they did all their, they sacrificed the kids or whatever, the Avodah Zarah, whatever they bad things they did there. Hashem sent Yirmiyahu to go mamish inside with these Avodah Zarah, and Rav Moshe, and then Yirmiyahu spoke to them. So Rav Moshe doesn't think it's a problem to go to even to Makomos of Avodah Zarah. And he says, Rav Moshe says, every place where the Jews are, yesh inyan malachas lo diyam darchei Hashem v'taraso. There's a reason, wherever Jews are, you should go and preach the good word. That's actually Rav Schechter's opinion. In England, they say you can't go to the Limud conferences, or in America, people say, because the conservative are there and the reform. And Rav Schechter says, no, you have to go, because otherwise then they'll only hear the other side. And so that's Rav Moshe, though. So it's quite interesting. He says you have to consider, though, it could be in cases that it's going to give them a hechsher, but they have to consider it. But Meikar did, not a problem. And to this Rabbi Bloch, he said, no issue from Halacha. But then the next page. Remember when we saw Rav Moshe signs the open letter with all the other Rosh Yeshiva saying you can't be on a joint board of rabbis and you can't be on a synagogue council. So listen to this. Rabbi Kalman Winter. I never knew him. I'm sure some of you knew him. I Googled his name. He was the son-in-law of Amos Bunim. So he was the rabbi in Buffalo. And he asked the question to Rav Moshe, can I be a member of the Vad Rabbanim of Buffalo, which has reform and conservative rabbis? So obviously the answer is going to be no. Rav Moshe says you can't be on a joint board. That's the whole letter he signed. And Rav Moshe said, New York. You can't compare the Vada Rabbanim of New York, which I assert, to the place in Buffalo. Why? Because in Buffalo, they're only asukim binyanei tzibur. They're only involved in things, you know, for the community, and therefore mutar litzaref amahem, because you can even join with non-Jews for the betterment of the Jewish community. Only if they join linyanei dat for in religious matters is it usur. So he said to him, you could join it. Now, but wait a second. In New York, the Board of Rabbis also didn't do religious things. You have to conclude from this that Rav Moshe either was misinformed and thought that in New York, the Board of Rabbis did do religious things, or he thought that New York's a different case, maybe. It's a very big, it's a huge community, and the rabbis don't need to, because there's enough Orthodox that the, you know, you don't need, there's enough conservative and Orthodox, each can do their own thing. But in a place like Buffalo, where it's very small and it's important to get together, whatever it is, here you have Beferish Rav Moshe giving permission. No one would believe me if I said this, but here it is in the Masoras Moshe. Rav Moshe saying in a small town like Buffalo to be on a board of rabbis, Sheyesham Chaverim Shen Reformim, which has non-Orthodox Jew rabbis, Rabbi Winter, you can be on it, and it's for the good of Kol Yisrael. You know, you go to the governor, let's say, you go together, or the mayor, you go, both rabbis go, and you make a case, it's a lot better, you know. It's a contradiction. It absolutely is a contradiction. So we have to explain, you have to, you know, tarte de satre, but you have to explain the stira, like we always do. There has to be an explanation. And you can come up with a couple like I just mentioned. But here we see that Rav Moshe is definitely not like the other Roshi Yeshiva, in that he was willing in individual cases like this. I'm sure they hate the fact that this was recorded, that Rav Moshe acknowledged that in cases like this, you could be a rabbi on the board like this, because he says you could be with non-Jews. You know, if there's a group for the betterment of Israel, let's say, and all the non-Jews are coming together and they ask the Jews to join, of course you can. So he says you can be with the non-Orthodox rabbi. That's very interesting. Let's put it that way. And it complicates the story. Exactly. I want to show what I found just this week. I've seen this already, but this is an earlier one. I was at the Center of Jewish History. I'm on sabbatical now. Baruch Hashem, I have a whole semester. It's the greatest thing. I have to wait every 7 years, though. But they pay full salary one semester, not full salary the whole year. But at least I got one semester. The problem is, look at this. I can't type and I can't write. So, but it's coming off, they say, in a couple of weeks. And so I have time to go to the archives, do the things I like to do. Lo and behold, I went to the Center for Jewish History, and I found, let me show you what I found. Hold on. Here. I found something from 46, Synagogue Council of America. Look who it's signed by. Who's the president? Herbert S. Goldstein is one of the leading Orthodox rabbis, and although the stationery needs to be updated, because here it lists Isaac Landsman as president. So who's on this? Who's Orthodox? Simon Kramer. He later becomes head of Skokie or Chicago. This William Weiss. I didn't know who William Weiss was, so I Googled it. William Weiss was the head of the OU. Because look, take a look at this. Where is it? The Synagogue Council of America includes the Rabbinical Council of America and the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. So this is what we're talking about. This is what the whole dispute was about. When I Googled Weiss's name, lo and behold, it came up from 34. Weiss rebukes Rabbi Konvitz over Kashrus. Rabbi Konvitz was a Rav in Newark, the son-in-law of the Ritbaz. Sharp criticism of the statement issued by Rabbi Joseph Konvitz last Sunday challenging the authority of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations in questions of kosher regulation was voiced by William Weiss, president of the union. What happened is that the old-time Rabboni from the Gudas Rabboni, they were very critical of the OU. And they said, you can't trust the OU Hashgacha. And they said, it's Masi Gvul. Remember, these old-time rabbis made their living on kosher, many of them. In fact, Rav Moshe has a tshuva about this, that you can't take away Hashgacha from the old rabbis for the new organizations. He means the OU. But the OU, you know, there was a lot of hefkeiros and there's a lot of conflicts going on. So the OU wanted to have one, standard with, and what does he says? He says that, Weiss says that this is an attempt on the part of rabbinical groups to assume for its individual rabbis the sole authority to issue kosher sanctions. During the past few years, the union has been endeavoring to establish order in the chaotic field of kosheris. The kosheris policy of the union is a non-commercial one. It is opposed to charging fees for hechshering. The union feels that the Jewish public should not be given any grounds for a complaint that prices of food products are excessively increased because of kosheris. This is 1934. And look at this. The OU doesn't charge. It's all free. It's a service. Obviously, things have changed. OU charges, I don't know if they charge a lot. They make a lot. Since the OU is chartered as a church, a religious institution, we don't know what they actually make. It's a big secret. You can't go on GuideStar like you can go on, all other nonprofits and see how much money is made. So it's like a chartered as a synagogue. But they make a lot of money. They support all these good institutions, like the SJ, whatever they call it, the rabbis on campus. I forget what they call them, and all sorts of other things. But now look what it says. The Union of Orthodox Organizations lists among its members Rabbis Leo Young, Herbert Goldstein, Bernard Drachman, Moses Hyamson, H. Pereira Mendes, David Asola Poole, Joseph Lookstein, and then some politicians, State Senator Albert Wald, Harry Fischel, State Supreme Court Justice Hofstadter, etc. Now, those are all fine, nice rabbis, but you're living in 1934, and you're a yeshivish type of a religious or a guy from Eastern Europe. On the one hand, you have the Gedolei Yisrael, all the great old-fashioned European rabbis who know Shas and Poskim backwards and forwards. And then you have these other modern type of rabbis, great orators, influential. It's sort of, you can see how you would favor the other rabbis. But historically, the OU was doing the proper thing, the better thing, because I guess you needed their minds, their modern type of forward-thinking, sophisticated minds to conclude that, we need to have a better system than the local rabbis. But if I was living then, and I'm like I am now, if it's Rabbi Konvitz and all these other big rabbanim versus these modern rabbis on the Upper East Side, I think I'm going to go with the old-fashioned rabbis who are the Gaonim and Shas and Poskim. And but that was, I wrote about it on the Sfarim blog a couple of years ago, the Machlokas, where Agudas Rabboni declares that the OK, you can't eat from the OK, the guy's an ignoramus. I mean, the guy who ran the OK was a chemist, and he was telling the Rabboni what's kosherous and what's not. In some areas, he probably was right, because he knew about the chemistry, but they saw it as complete chutzpah, and they put the OK and him in Chayrim, by the way. The OK only became acceptable when it was sold to Rabbi Levi. Okay, I want to now move on to the last segment of the, the controversy or the discussions about separatism. And we spoke about Eretz Yisrael, and I just want to turn to Rav Kook and his school, because you do find something interesting. And for Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rabbi Bamberger, and we're going to return after this, we finish this, we're back to Rabbi Bamberger. I think I have two classes, all sorts of good stuff about Rabbi Bamberger before we close it out. And by the way, I know people think they're looking online, they're seeing like 10 talks on Rabbi Bamberger, but we do have, I have members of the family, grandchildren from Europe, I'm sure in America also, but in England and elsewhere, listening to the classes. So that's nice. But Rabbi Bamberger assumes a role as an icon for Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and if you believe him, for Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen. So let's talk about that for a little and turn to the school, in quotes, of Rav Kook. And what I'm going to share with you now actually was published in the Daniel Sperber Jubilee volume. I published an article on Hirsch's, the reception of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch among the Haredim and among the religious Zionists, and you can see the article on my academia page. So why do I mention this? Because I think a lot of people probably look at the article and they start looking the first few pages, skimming through it, and they're like, hey, I know all this. Because the first part of the article is reprinted pretty much, most of it, in Changing the Immutable, when I dealt with the Haredim and Hirsch and all about the kippah and all that. But if you just keep going to the second part of the article, it's not reprinted. It's all new stuff. It's about Rav Kook and his school and Hirsch. So it's worth skimming a few more pages. And look, we know that for the Haredim, they want to make Hirsch a gadol for their communities, and therefore the issue they have to deal with is Torah and Derech Eretz. How can he be a gadol if he advocates Torah and Derech Eretz? So they have their ways of dealing with that. The followers of Rav Kook, however, they have a different problem. Not Torah and Derech Eretz. Their problem is Austrit, separatism. And therefore, they feel the Haredim build Hirsch up, and they do that by creating like a verbessert version, an improved, a better version of Rav Hirsch in their model, because they want to include him in the canon. And I think the reason they want to is because Agudas Yisrael really comes into German Orthodoxy, and it's important. Look, they have so many Gedolim. They don't need Hirsch. So they have lots of Gedolim, but they want him. The school of Rav Kook, they want to remove Hirsch from the pedestal because of Austrit, which goes against their ideology. They're not really bothered by Hirsch's anti-Zionism. We know about his anti-Zionism. He writes that what Ritzihirsch Kalischer thought of as a great mitzvah, settling the land, he thought of it as not a small aveira. This isn't a major point in the opposition of the Hirsch, of the Cookian school to Rabbi Hirsch, because look, there's lots of Gedolim who are anti-Zionists, so you don't need to focus on Hirsch. But Austrit is in a different category. Remember, the principle of Austrit, which is one of the guiding lights of Rav Shamsher Raphael Hirsch, becomes the ideology of the German Aguda. It's the ideology of the Jerusalem separatist community, the Yed HaCharedit, which refused to be part of the larger community. For Rav Kook, on the other hand, a major part of his philosophy was the unity of the Jewish people, especially in the land of Israel. Even the sinners are playing an important role. And therefore, Rav Kook is strongly opposed to any sorts of religious separatism. He actually refers to it as a thought of idolatry, and describe those who support separatism as, quote, doing the work of a Moloch. Ritzvi Yehuda actually censored this when it appeared. He censored it so that he says the ideology of separatism is the deed of a Moloch. But Rav Kook himself actually says that those who advocate separatism are doing the deed of a Moloch. Remember, a Moloch, it attacked the weak. It tried to separate the Jews. And that's what Rav Kook says. Now, the importance of this in Rav Kook's eyes is seen that on his deathbed, he repeated his call to reject religious separatism and calls it, quote, the foundation of heresy. He says also in Mamre Riyah, it's derech aminos mamash v'chol yisod harayon shehotzas poshe Yisrael mikol ha'oma halohu rayon pasul. That is, the ideas of heresy and of separating the sinners from the nation, it's a false ideology. It's derech aminos. Now with what he's saying is that the derech of minus, of heresy, comes out, as he'll explain, arises from separatism, this false ideology. So with such a strong anti-Austrit stand, it's understandable that the followers of Kook would look to downgrade Hirsch's significance. And this really is seen prominently with the son, Ritzvi Yehuda Kook, who we've had classes on Ritzvi Yehuda. And as with the Haredim, Ritzvi Yehuda focuses on the issue of Austrit. We spoke about how the Aguda never really had any desire to separate officially. However, the ideal of removing yourself as much as possible from the irreligious was always present. And Hirsch's words were cited. After all, Hirsch spoke about the danger of being in proximity to heresy. That's an idea that continues even if officially you're part of the State of Israel or the Vad HaLeumi. Before there's a State of Israel, there's something called the Vad HaLeumi. And Agudistan, who came from Poland and Lithuania, never separated. They joined the Vad HaLeumi. And the Chazon Ish actually writes, in opposition to the separatists, he writes that this is no different than what we have in Lithuania and Poland. You know, as long as you have a rabbi, who is good for the community and is not forced by the irreligious to do things, then fine, we can have our communities. Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, he was very close with Rav Kook or Tzvi Pesach Frank. He had no relationship with really with these Hungarians who ran the Eda Charidit and others. But when Tzvi Pesach Frank writes to Rav Chaim Moser, asking him to declare the Shlita of the Eda Charidit posel, because it's Masi Gvul, Rav Chaim Moser writes back to him that, you know, I'm not going to do that. And it's good. It's always, he basically says, it's good to have people on the right. They keep us honest and they keep you, it's nothing wrong if they want to have it. If their philosophy is that they want to be separatists, we can't forbid them. They have the right to do that. Rav Chaim Moser is saying that. Now, he is not part of that community and has nothing to do with them. But I have to say, although Rav Chaim Moser and the Lithuanian Gedolim all associated with Rav Kook and Tzvi Pesach Frank, and they regarded them as the Rabbanim, not the separatists, even though technically they were connected to, with, through the Aguda with the separatists, on a few occasions, they did sign public declarations that said that Jews in Eretz Yisrael should join the separatist community. Now, no one listened to it, and none of the Agudistan who moved there listened to it. The German Orthodox, they started to join the separatist community, but they're like, these are sophisticated, secularly educated German Orthodox. How can they be in a community which says that has a cherem on the Hebrew language? So it never worked. But here you have this issue, and you can see in the biography of Rosenfeld, Maradar Yisrael, how do you explain how in Lithuania and Poland, there's no separatism and no desire for it. And in and yet you do have people, even rabbis, I think even Rav Chaim Moser, signing these things. You know, they're asked by the Aguda in Jerusalem to sign this, and they do sign it, that the Jews in Israel should join the separatist community. Either you could say they're just doing it to go along with what they're asked to do, but I think it's more than that. I think, remember, in Eretz Yisrael, you already had a separatist community. So as long as you already had a separatist community, then if you have a choice, be part of the separatist community. When there's a state of Israel, you can't be in a separatist community. Of course not. You got to be part of the state because the money, the taxes, and all that. But when before there's a state, now in Lithuania and Poland, they didn't have separatist communities. So you're going to say, well, you should try to fight for it like Hirsch did and change the law. You know, in theory, they could have fought in Poland and Lithuania. Maybe they could have passed a law. They never thought it was important. They never thought it was a big deal. Some people were opposed ideologically. We saw the Nitziv. He was ideologically opposed to this. Others were as well. I don't think Rav Chaim Moser was opposed ideologically. If all of a sudden the government of Poland, because Vilna was part of Poland between the war, if the government of Poland decided, you know, the Orthodox now have their own communities, I'm sure Rav Chaim Moser would have said, okay, from now on, we need to be part of our own communities, not one overarching community. But it isn't something worth fighting over, making an issue for. It's, they didn't make it. I think that's best how to explain it. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda creates this whole, I have to say, with all due respect to him, a whole fiction of the history of German Orthodoxy. And I told this story once, actually at the Sephardic Institute, and I was there for Shabbos once, and lo and behold, in the audience was one of the big students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And I'm talking about how Rav Tzvi Yehuda creates his whole myth, and it's all not true, but it serves his purpose. And I thought, you know, with these Hasidim, of big rabbis, they get very offended because their attitude is like, the rabbi can never be wrong and this and that. And the rabbi was Rabbi Avi Gisser. I don't know if anyone knows the name from Ofra. He was a rabbi for many years of Ofra. You can look him up. I then later learned, and when speaking to him, I saw that he's not like these Chardal, just close-minded types. He's actually one of the founders of Tzohar, even though he was the modern, like, Orthodox rabbinic organization. So even though he was a close student of Tzvi Yehuda, afterwards I went up to him and I said that, you know, what Tzvi Yehuda said really isn't true. And he said, yes, we know it's not true. But, you know, in other words, he understood. He didn't take it personally like that. What is this? Well, Tzvi Yehuda creates this fiction, this myth of these two people. One great rabbi, Bamberger, and the other, basically the equivalent of a good speaker, who's a pulpit rabbi who can have a good influence in his writing, but is in a completely separate league, and not just the league that Bamberger said, different league, but doesn't see him as a significant personality at all. And, well, so for instance, he begins by talking about how what Hirsch did was terrible because he split the community. And not only did he split it, he didn't really have support. Mircea Eluda, in his version of it, says there was 11 people who joined with Hirsch to create this separatist community, and many observant Jews did not. Well, this isn't true. 11 people started the community, the Gesellschaft, as it was called. But when it invited in 1851 Hirsch to be rabbi, there was some hundred, they say members, I think that means families. And by the time the government permits Elstritt, another 20 years later, there's many, many more. So this idea that it's a bunch of malcontents who just decide to bring Hirsch in, and Hirsch agrees to go there, and it creates havoc in the Kehilla Kadosha, that's not true at all. Ratzi Yehuda also says that when it became possible for the Orthodox to officially separate from the general community, the Gedolim in Germany refused to. And he says, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and who are the Gedolim, he says, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the Würzburger Rav, and Rav Moshe Mainz of Frankfurt. And Ratzi Yehuda leaves no doubt that for whatever good qualities Hirsch has, he's not one of the Gedolim. That is, he's Rav Hirsch, Zichron Livracha. He's not Haga'on, Haggadol, anything like that. And he can't measure up to Ettlinger, Bamberger, or even Moshe Mainz. Well, again, with all due respect to Ratzi Yehuda. Now, what I'm saying now, I'm just repeating, there's a scholar, a rabbi in Israel from the German community, David Henschke. And he's really an expert in the Rambam, and in a lot of areas, actually, yeah. In Talmudic literature, he wrote a book on the Haggadah Shel Pesach, I believe, the development. But he, so this isn't even his area, but these are like Devarim Yiduim, known things. Anyone who's like educated or from a German Orthodox family could have responded. He writes in the letter, the journal Hamayan, how it's really painful for him to respond openly and, Ratzi Yehuda was a great tzaddik. I'm not saying he was a gadol in Shas and Poske, but he was a tzaddik. He had tzaddik yisod olam. No question about it. The son, as we say, benan shel kadoshim. These are the words that Henschke uses. It's not a pleasant task to publicly, show that someone is wrong and made a mistake. I had a situation myself once, not that I had a chance to publicly point out a mistake, and it was a bad one, but I decided not to. On the blog post, I discussed it with someone, because this person is a gadol b'Yisrael. Everyone would know his name. And whatever, I don't need to point out everyone's errors. It's enough that they point out my errors. I don't need to point out everyone's errors. Kavodah Torah. I point out the errors sometimes, and there's nothing wrong with pointing out errors. Everyone has errors, but this was like a bad one. But what Ratzi says is completely wrong. This idea that Hirsch advocated Austrit in opposition to the Chachmei Torah. First of all, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger dies before they're allowed to separate. And there's no evidence that he opposed separatism. On the contrary, Rebecca Vettlinger speaks about how we should be as distant as we can from the reformers. It's true that he doesn't want to put them in Cheirim. He has a letter to Rav Shlomo Eger saying we're not going to put them in Cheirim. But that doesn't mean you're together with them, because putting them in Cheirim means they're not part of the Jewish people anymore. But, look how, I want to read you how, after describing the Gedolim, Bamberger and Ettlinger, this is how he describes Hirsch. Hoge deyot v'sofer, shechiber sfarim chashuvim, aval lo habasis shalom danut toronit gedula. That is, he's a thinker and a writer, he wrote some good books, important books, but he does have the basis of great Torah learning. So there's a, because they opposed Austrit, Hirsch, who's the big advocate of it, his significance has to be lessened. Now, as for Bamberger, we've already seen Bamberger, contrary to Ratzi Yehuda, Bamberger never speaks against Austrit. He never said it's forbidden. He never says it's splitting the Jewish people, anything like that. What he says is there's no obligation. And we know at other times Bamberger did advocate separatism. But if the community gives you everything you need, there no longer is an obligation. And if you remain in the community, there's even positive things you can do. You can bring them close to religion. But if you choose to leave the community, That's 100% permissible also, and there's positive things you can do as well. In other words, he left it as an option, and he never said that one way is better, and he certainly, contrary to his view, never said that it's forbidden, and separatism is wrong, and it divides Jewish people. He never said this. He was not, on principle, an opponent of separatism. It had Ritzvi decided the Mate Levi or Mordechai Harvitz, they were in Frankfurt, he would be absolutely correct, but not Reb Bamberger. Listen, Ritzvi Yehuda says, he loves this part where when Hirsch says to Bamberger, "How do you contradict me? I'm the Rav of the community." So Ritzvi Yehuda says, he actually gets this wrong also. Remember, it was Bamberger himself says, but we're not Chaverim, I'm greater. But the way Ritzvi Yehuda tells the story is the followers of Rav Bamberger came to Hirsch and said, "With all due respect to Rabbi Hirsch, you're not the equal of the Gaon of Würzburg and Talmud and Poskim. You have to listen to the psak of one of the Gedolei Ador, not the reverse." Okay, but as we saw, it was actually Bamberger who said, "I don't have to listen to you, Hirsch, because I can give my own psak, because although the halacha is, when one rav decides that another rav can't contradict it, that only means, that's only if they're at equal level, not if one is greater." And by the way, Rav Bamberger never said to Hirsch, "You have to listen to my psak." I mean, Ritzvi Yehuda tells it like they said to Rav Hirsch, since the Gadol Hador, Rav Bamberger gives his psak, "You, Hirsch, have to be mevatel your opinion, and you have to now follow Bamberger." No one said that, and Bamberger never said that. All Bamberger said is that the members of the Frankfurt community can listen to me, because I've given a psak. He never said that Hirsch, you yourself are obligated to listen to me, and he never even said that the members of the Frankfurt community are obligated to listen to him. He said that if they want to listen to him, they can. But if they want to be a separatist and not pay double taxation, they can do that as well. So wait till you hear next, maybe another 10 minutes this, 5 minutes, wait till you hear where Ritzvi Yehuda. Where did the ideology, this puzzle, phony, false to Torah ideology of Austerlitz comes from? That, again, with all due respect to Ritzvi Yehuda, that's the ultimate creation of a myth. This he's basically Bekitzer, and I'll get to him more detail next class. Only from the impure German environment, only someone who's assimilated into that Germanic non-Jewish environment could such an ideology ever have arisen of Austerlitz, which again, so what are you going to tell me about the rabbis of Hungary, who were not at all assimilated, and they were as backwards, from general culture as can be imagined, and they also came up with the principle of Austerlitz. So, I mean, it's really interesting, Ritzvi Yehuda, but it's like, it's the creation of this myth that, I have a few more words to say about Ritzvi Yehuda. And by the way, his followers don't give up. There's a Rabbi Yosef Elner who wrote a whole piece in opposition to Henschke, and it's just wrong, wrong, wrong. And it's like Das Torah. From them, it's like the same thing as the Haredim. Ritzvi Yehuda is the Das Torah. So even if the facts don't agree, you have to come up with, so when you don't have the answers, Kellner says, well, we know that Ritzvi Yehuda must have had this knowledge because he didn't speak without the knowledge, and then he says something like, well, Gadol Yisrael are given the guidance, and therefore, I mean, it's, how can you argue when people come back to you, you give them facts, and they say, well, God watches over the righteous and all that sort of stuff. It's embarrassing, I think. And, that's the last thing I want to do. And then we're going to return for those of you who haven't been interested the last 4 weeks, all this great, I think 5 weeks about the separatism. I think it's great. And that's why we went on this long tangent. We're going to come back to Rabbi Bamberger, his history, the things he did in the community, some of his halachic tshuvot, and he wore a gown. Wait to hear about this. He looked just like Hirsch with that gown. Some of you are probably thinking of him like an East European old-fashioned rabbi because he's a traditional London gown. He wore the same sort of gown they all did. Wait till you hear about Rav Shmuel Salant. Rav Shmuel Salant comes all the way from Eretz Yisrael, and he comes and sees one of the Gedolei Yisrael looking like some Protestant minister. And wait, we'll get to that next class. But okay, let me get to the comments and questions here. Someone privately says that daughter's middle name is Elka. Yes, we have, we, The difference is, though, that with the women, like I said, is that many of the women would only have a shem chol. They wouldn't have a shem kodesh also, because they weren't, I guess, because they weren't called to the Torah. I can't cook now, so I don't know what the Yochanan, what your loan, what your file is. Susanna says the original is singable. Okay, we have to try it. With the same tune, you're saying? We have to, okay. You know what? I've learned that most things are singable. You can just lengthen it out a little, or you, it doesn't have to, everything doesn't have to agree. But the problem is that now you have a shul, some shuls, not many, but you have a few shuls that have the Koran sitter. And if you sing it, it's a problem because it doesn't really go together. I said Meir Porsche. No, it's Menachem Porsche. Thank you, Rabbi Yalin. Yes. Meir Porsche is someone else. That's his cousin. Meir Porsche was in Rav Kook's camp, and he wrote a whole history of the Yishuv HaYashon, the old Jerusalem. Menachem Porsche was in this Tzeirei Agudas Yisrael. This later he became very mainstream, and he became very respectful of Rav Kook, and he acknowledged that in his youth he was I wouldn't say a miscreant, but he was he was misled. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda held this against him the rest of his life and regarded him as in Cherem, because Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer put them all in Cherem, all these kids. Now, I don't know, if you have an 18-year-old, you put him in Cherem, does that mean the Cherem lasts for the next 60 years? I think we have to give some leeway for the youngsters. But it wasn't just the youngsters. You had crazy people who were not just youngsters in Jerusalem, real fanatics. People tried to injure Rav Kook physically. People tried to pour garbage on him. There was even, at least the accusation was made, that they wanted to push him off a building. Terrible stuff. Yes, Rav Moshe often used machine for car. But in his, that's in speaking, I guess. But in the tshuvos, it's car.
He also, in the Chuvas, he also has machine.
He has machine also, okay.
I used to say it. Machine, okay. Yes.
Machine. Zoom user, whoever that is, says the Rav refused to sign to Rav Moshe's Pesach about synagogue council. Yes, Rav Moshe said that the Rav refused to sign, drove a stake into the Pesach. Yeah, well, we discussed this last week. Look, had the Rav signed it, it would have been, they would have had the whole list of all the big Gedolim there, but the Rav didn't. And it wasn't just the Rav students. You had students from the other yeshivas who were also members of these things. And had the Rav signed it, then it would have been a problem for the graduates of Reitz. But the Rav did not think this was a halachic issue. He did not think halachically you could forbid. Look, the Rav refused to sign when the YU Rosh Yeshiva came out in the 80s, when Rabbi Simcha Krauss, they had the women's prayer group in his synagogue, and the YU Rosh Yeshiva came out with this statement, just like the statement against the synagogue council, just the declaration that it's forbidden. Later, Rav Schechter wrote a whole article explaining why, but the original statement was just a statement signed by Rav Schechter, Rabbi Rabbi Parnas, a few others, I forget who, I think it was five of them. The Rav refused to sign it, even though he opposed these women's prayer groups, but he said, how can I say it's usser? That's at least how it's recorded. The Rav said, I can't sign and say it's usser. It's forbidden, because it's not forbidden, he said. He just thinks it's wrong, and not everything that's wrong is forbidden. For a brisker, you have to be very careful. To say usser, it really has to be usser. Remember I told you that Reb Chaim had a big machokas with the other Rabbanim, because the other Rabbanim made a declaration that if someone doesn't circumcise their son, he can't be buried in the Jewish cemetery. I think that was the machokas. And Reb Chaim says, what does one thing after the other? He doesn't circumcise his son, that's an avera, but doesn't mean, since when is he can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery? That's one sin. And then there's something. The Rav was a stickler for that. Rabbi Lam had this argument. Yes, Rabbi Lam always said to speak. And look, it's not just Rabbi Lam, Rav Herschel Schechter. And we have a rabbi listening from Toronto who's had this experience in person about this. But I mean, this is again and again, Rabbi Soloveitchik. But I don't know if Rabbi Soloveitchik, I mean, today would say, I don't even know if in his day, if he said it's absolutely forbidden to go to, you know, again, there's a distinction. If you go to the conservative synagogue and you both are speaking on a panel, that maybe the Rav will be opposed. Rabbi Soloveitchik ever say there's a problem going in a non-Orthodox synagogue and speaking about, let's say, an Orthodox perspective? For heaven's sakes, the Rav went to St. John's Catholic seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts. That's where he presented the Lonely Man of Faith. If you can go speak in a Catholic seminary, I mean, going into the sanctuary, sometimes the rabbis have an issue with that. But just to go speak, I don't know if the Rav ever said that. His issue was giving legitimacy. If a conservative synagogue decides to invite an Orthodox rabbi to present the Torah perspective, I never heard that Rav Soloveitchik said that that's a problem. And when you go to Limud, it's each one speaks themselves. And you're correct, the person who's writing, that this came when the rabbi from Lakewood, who's a big Talmud Chacham, he wrote a sefer, Shufrei Deshtare, I think it is. Reisman, was is it Reisman? I forget his.
Reimann.
I forget the name of the what.
I think
what's
Reimann,
his
name? Though.
Reimann, yes. Yes, he did exactly what the Rav was opposed to and what all the Gedolim were opposed to. They wrote a book together and they appeared together. And the problem is that you listen to them both. What happens if the other guys, the Reform rabbi's arguments are better than Rabbi Reimann? And in one case, at least, absolutely it is, because Rabbi Reimann didn't know about Ibn Ezra's position about post-Mosaic authorship. So if you read that, you come out and you say, wait a second. If the Reform rabbi knows this and he knows more than Rabbi Reimann, then maybe in other things he does as well. So they shut that down very quickly. And that's Kalman Winter, yes, who was the leading Orthodox rabbi in Silver Spring. Exactly. There can't be more than one Kalman Winter. That's Amos Bunim, Irving Bunim, the great Orthodox lay leader whose biography was written by Amos Bunim. And many, many descendants almost spewed him. I mean, they're all over. It's a very important family and nephews and nieces. But, and that Kalman Winter, I didn't know Kalman Winter was son of Eli. I saw this in the Masoret Moshe. Yes, JLIC. Why didn't young Israel join the synagogue council? Good question. I guess they thought, I don't know. It's because in the 30s, they were not a right-wing organization, or the 40s. You know, they didn't like rabbis to begin with in the early years, but by the 50s, it wasn't a right-wing organization. I don't know why they didn't join it. Remember, they were more, the young Israel always insisted on machitza. They were more in that way, they were more sticklers for the definition of orthodoxy. The OU was full of orthodox, so-called, not so-called, orthodox shuls without machitzas. The young Israel didn't. M.J. Franco says, Jacob Rosenheim in particular, a major founding father of the Aguda, was a congregant of Hirsch in his latter days and revered his Rebbe. You know, Ritzi Yehuda deals with Rosenheim also. Ritzi Yehuda, here's another example of the myth. He says that how can you compare Mizrahi to Aguda? Aguda was founded by Yaakov Rosenheim, who was a very dignified balabas, but you're going to compare that to Mizrahi, founded by Rav Reines, who was a gadol in learning? Okay, if you look at it that way, of course, Mizrahi is much more significant. But Agudas Yisrael wasn't just founded by Rosenheim. Yes, maybe they came up with the idea, and they were the ones who knew how to organize conventions. But, you know, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, I hate to say it, but lots of Gedolim were involved in the founding of Aguda. They were not the originators, but they joined on. You saw the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski and all the rest of them. So, I mean, Rav Tzvi Yehuda knew this. I mean, he was friends with these Rabbanim also, but he said the ideology came. But it's not, what can I say? It's not true. And Nissen says, the meaning of Chardal has changed. Ezra, the Tzofim, proudly identified as a Norah Haredet Tilami. I did not know that that they identified that way. Ezra is already was in Germany. That was the German youth organization, Ezra. I didn't know. But you know what? When you say Hanorah
Haredet, in my own youth, I saw, yes, I saw it myself. Their headquarters, I was only a child in the 1980s, I'm in the old Chorev Shul in Rehavia.
And he had that title?
It said on the building. Yes, that's where I saw it. That's where okay. I saw it
because,
myself on the building.
Because, you know, in the earlier years, by the 80s already, we have a concept of Haredi. But earlier, Haredi just meant Dati. There was no difference. In fact, one of the big Mizrahi newspapers, the heading of it, it calls itself like a Yadut HaCharedit or something like that. Yochanan. Yes, your hand is raised. Thank you, Ruth.
The OU was Ichud HaKilot HaCharediot BaAmerika. I still have that stationery from the 1990s. That's what it said
nice.
Inside
Thank
the circle.
You.
They changed
okay.
Orthodoxy.
Okay, thank you. Yochanan, your hand is raised.
Hey, Professor, I have so many comments, I can't, but I won't keep you for 3 hours.
The best, yeah.
I sent you a link in the chat here. Essay not published yet, Redefining Orthodoxy about Mendelssohn's Beer and Weisel. And I have a letter about it from Professor Lyman and from Benjamin Rav Hamburger. So I wonder what you think about it.
Send it to me. It's hard for me to get it now. Send it to my email and I'll look at it. The question is Mendelssohn. Hirsch thought Mendelssohn was part of Orthodoxy, and certainly Wesley. And many people thought Wesley were part of Orthodoxy. His books are quoted by many, included by Ritzi Yehuda. That's a different issue, but I'll look at it and I can comment if it's relevant to the class. If not, I'll comment privately to you.
Yeah, I bet you will be very surprised with the information there. But it's not just about old rabbis. It's also about Haredi rabbis today in regards to Wesley and stuff like this. But where can I find your email address?
Just Google my name or email Torah in Motion. I'll give it to you, or I'll write it in here on my comments. So everyone can get my email. If you look in the books of Wesley that were published by the late Rav Tsuriel, he published one anonymously under pseudonym, but then he published it with his name. He has a big introduction with lots of Rabbanim, including from the Musar school, that Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm and many others. They liked Wesley very much. Mendelssohn, we have the article by Meir Hildesheimer, who lists numerous Gedolim. Even though the Chassam Sofer opposed it, the Maharam Shik read the Biur, and the Maharam Shik was his biggest Talmud. Let me quickly, just two more minutes. Someone says that it's going to take a while before the real issues of Aguda, the history, and in Israel, when Yitzhak Breuer comes there, and he had a whole notion of Torah's Eretz Yisrael and all that. That's going to take a little while to come to be. And Yaakov Rosenheim, he says, was opposed to Austria and Eretz Yisrael. There's something else of interest. The Aguda, once the state gets going, or even 47, the Aguda in Israel under the Ger Rebbe is much more moderate than the Aguda in Chutzlaritz, including the Aguda of the Rosenheim. Rosenheim was opposed to the ouster of the Eda Haredit, but he was a bit of an extremist, and also Harry Goodman in London. So while we know that the Agudistin in Israel were very upset with what the Agudistin outside of Israel were doing, because they weren't there, they weren't on the scene, and they were trying to be like anti-Zionist types in Chutzlaritz. So, okay, there's a lot to discuss. As I said, next class, we will finish up with this Austrit and we'll return back to the great Gaon, Rav Zalman Baer Bamberger. Thank you all for coming out. Paul, you didn't say anything. Do you know anything about Harry Goodman?
You're muted, Paul. You're muted.
Yeah, I know a great deal about Harry Goodman. Actually, his son's stepson is the assistant rabbi here, one of the assistant rabbis here in Palm Beach. And he was an interesting character.
Yeah, but he was one of these people. He wasn't a rav or anything. But no, so Agudas Yisrael, the real history which written will show. First, I have to get into the archives. I tried to get into the archives years ago. They won't let me in. You need to get into the archives. There's been a good book. Like I just showed you that book. He got into the archives. It shows a lot, but there's a lot more. And the back and forth, if we could ever really get the minutes of the Moetzes Gedolia Torah as arguing about these matters, because you had the Hasidic Rebbes, like from Sadegur and things that were basically Zionists. And the Ger Rebbe was pretty Zionistic. And then you had others who were really like anti-Zionist or non-Zionist, how they work these things out. And then with the German Orthodox and, Mordechai Breuer declared in the 1960s, he says, there's no longer a place for us in the Aguda. There always was a place for the German Orthodox and we founded it, but eventually it became so yeshivish that they don't even validate our lifestyle. So Agudas Yisrael, it's a fascinating movement, a fascinating history. Yes. Final comment, Nissen. Nissen, I can't hear you.
Hear us? You're muted, Nissen.
Okay. I have a final contribution about Harry Goodman. At the Shloshim Haskara of Rav Kalman Kahana, Rav Schachter spoke, and our Ruv, the Kaysmarker Ruv, of the Poale Gutta Bar Park spoke. He had personally attended the Aguda Knessia Gadola held immediately after World War II. And he recounted how Harry Goodman, that was the first time I heard the name, Harry Goodman spoke and said, we have to support the British government. We can't go against the white paper. And everybody, I couldn't mention, everybody chuckling. Yeah, yeah. There was one young man from Eretz Yisrael, from the Yishuv. His name was Kalman Kahana. And he got up and he spoke against Harry Goodman, of course, and said how we all must get our brethren to come into Eretz Yisrael, no matter what the obstacles are. So that's how I heard of this Harry Goodman. I would add some more words, but we're being recorded, so I will stop.
No, it's interesting because he's an important balabas, a very interesting and a good big Askan, but he was pushing the anti-Zionist endeavor at the same time that you had people like the Ger Rebbe in his circle that were going in a different direction. That's an inner Aguda fight. You had that fight at the Knessia and Marienbad between, we spoke about, Reb Chanan Wasserman and Reb Aaron Cutler on the one side versus Reb Cyrilson and you know, Hasidic Rebbe's on the other side. Agudas Yisrael fought this battle out among itself, what to do with the state. So, well, thank you all. Look, we can go on talking with very interesting stuff. And I feel so many people who know so much, and the ones who write to me. So shkoyach very much. And I guess you'd say final words, Rabbi Kelman.
No, I don't. I can't imagine the Moetzer Gedolei Torah had minutes of their meetings. I don't know. I find that to find those minutes, they actually keep minutes. I don't know.
When the German Orthodox were running it, they definitely would have had minutes.
Okay, that idea.
In fact, at the Marienbad convention, they had minutes.
The father was a secretary. He was the secretary. He has the minutes. Ask Rabbi Yoel.
Who has the minutes now?
I don't know, but he had the minutes.
They're not supposed to have machokas. The gedolim are supposed to battle it out, and then they come to a decision, and then they're supposed to have a united front when they issue their ruling.
Our Canadian cabinet, that's how the cabinet works in Canada. Yeah. They're not allowed to, they really are. They're not allowed to speak about all the disputes they have in the Trudeau cabinet or any other cabinet.
That makes sense. Anyway. I get it. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please God, see you next week. Everybody be well. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, of course, class on Kohelet and all the regular classes during the week. Everybody should have Laila Tov, Besorot Tovot, and look forward to learning with you. And as I keep saying now, in the winter, our new sort of Sman, please invite a friend to come and join us who hasn't yet experienced all the wonderful classes at Torah Motion. So Laila Tov, everybody be well. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Rabbi Laila Tov.